Well, I think of it like a snow globe. So like, and I felt like that ever since I got diagnosed, that like before I like lived in the real world and I was like a part of it, and I like went to work and I contributed to the world, and I had like this thing that I was doing and what I was working towards, and it was like a ladder to like my future, right? But now I like live in a snow globe. I can still see everything that's going on outside, and I can like kind of interact with them, but it's like muffled. Like I'm not really a part of it. Like my experience is not entirely like their experience now. It's like I'm closed off.
Kia ora and welcome to The C Word, Kiwis Talk About Cancer. I'm your host, Helen King, and this is the podcast for cancery people. If you enjoy today's episode, subscribe on Spotify or iTunes, or come say hi on Facebook. I love hearing from you. When I interviewed my guest for today, I was left thinking that there is no fairness in cancer. It does not matter if you're a good person, if you've lived a healthy life, you can still get cancer. I was really struck afterwards that my guest is the type of person that if we had met in real life, we would have got on really well. I could imagine sitting down with her and just trying to solve the world's problems. But this is the reality of advanced cancer. We miss out on having incredible people in our lives. And I found that profoundly sad to think about. Libby Porter is 36, and she has incurable breast cancer. She lives in Calgary, Canada, with her husband and two-year-old daughter. Libby is unlikely to watch her baby grow up. Her daughter Violet was a few months old when she was initially diagnosed with breast cancer. She had noticed changes in her breast as far back as 2017, but she had put it down to hormonal changes as she had miscarried before becoming pregnant with Violet.
When I looked it up, I was like, nah, I'm not going to get that. Like, it's like not a young people disease. I wasn't too worried. And the lump, it didn't feel like what I thought it would feel like. Like, I thought it would be like a very like distinct, like round lump, but it was just almost like one breast was like a little bit harder in one spot than the other. And, but then it was like, it was the ducts, right? Like I was feeling the ducts, and I'm like, no, I have that on both sides. Like it's fine. And then my boobs got bigger because I got pregnant, and I actually had, I lost a pregnancy at 20 weeks. So, I mean, that was a long time for them to be getting bigger. And then I wasn't pregnant for 4 months, and then I was pregnant again. So I was pregnant for like nearly probably total 13 months with only 4 months in between. More than 13 months, 14 months with 4 months in between. So my boobs were like changing size a lot, and they were a lot bigger, and it was a lot harder to feel it. But when I was 8 months pregnant with my daughter, I was at the OBGYN's office and I said, hey, you know, I've got this lump in my boob. Could you like check it out? And she looked at it and she's like, and this was her, what's it called? Like the person, she wasn't a trained doctor. It was like a girl who was there learning to be a doctor, like a resident, I think it's called. So this resident was the one who looked at it and she said, you know, you're fine. Like I can feel something too, but don't worry about it. Like have your baby and finish breastfeeding and then come back. So, I mean, for some people, like that would have been a full year. For me, it was only 8 months, but it was a long time. And she never mentioned it to my OBGYN, my obstetrician gynecologist. She never told her that there was anything there. So very frustrating. So then I went back when I was done all that to my doctor and he gave me an ultrasound rec. And I went to the ultrasound with my daughter and I was just really feeling like, you know, it's going to be fine. Like it's just a blocked duct or something. Like it really wasn't even on my mind that it could be something like super serious. So when I was at the, when I laid down on the ultrasound table, I didn't know this was going to be like a life changing day in my life. I thought it was just like a regular day. And they looked it in and they're like, okay, well we need to do a mammogram. And I thought this is normal. This is what they always do. So I waited for the mammogram and they did it. And they're like, we see a lot of calcifications. And I remember going home and looking that up and I was like, oh, that's an early cancer. I'm sure it'll be like, it'll be fine. And then my doctor, he called me back and he had me come in and he's like, yeah, I think you have breast cancer. And he's like, but my wife has it. You can talk to her. Well, his wife had a stage one cancer, like found on a scan. So I was like, no, thank you. I'll be okay. And I never went to see him again because I knew that I would punch him in the face if I ever saw him again. So yeah, after that, I found out that I had stage 3A breast cancer. And I went through all the treatment for it, like the early stage treatment. I did the ACT, it's called here, chemo regimen. I did the dose dense type. She told me that would be better. She put me on Lupron to like literally shut down my ovaries. She gave me an AI in addition to that. And I did radiation. So I did like the whole thing. And then like, I was like, well, why are we going to do something after? Like, will we do scans and screenings to follow up? She's like, oh, we don't do that. Just come back when it hurts. And then like, we'll tell you if you have stage four cancer. And I was like, well, why don't you like scan and like check up on people? She's like, it doesn't make a difference. Like it won't make a difference in your survival. So we don't bother. But my surgeon, he said that he would check up on things. So I decided to try and go once a year. So a year later from like the first diagnosis, again in April, I went for a PET scan and they're like, there's a lesion on your sacrum, but we think you just injured yourself because of the shape of it. It doesn't look like a secondary cancer. He's like, but I want you to go for a bone scan and for an x-ray. And then I got the report by email. It was like a Friday afternoon. And it just said that they thought it was metastasis. And then my doctor called back the next week. She's like, no, it's not metastasis. Like, you wouldn't get one met like that. That's not going to happen. She's like, we can just watch and wait if you want. And I said, no, let's do a biopsy. And we did a biopsy and it was metastasis. So it was just one. And it's been, I guess, a year almost. It will be a year in April. And since then, so she put me on Ibrance, which is a CDK4/6 inhibitor, a newish drug. And she put me onto Falcidex, which is a different estrogen inhibitor. And then 3 months later, we did another scan. And it looked like it was fine. It actually looked like things had got better. But then they insisted I go for an MRI as well. So I'm here thinking everything's good. And the MRI guy, he calls me. He's like, well, you have four additional lesions on your spine now in 3 months. And we decided it might have been a tumor flare. So she decided to keep me on Ibrance and Falcidex for longer. So we waited another 4 months and did a PET. And we hadn't done a PET since May. And when we did the PET scan, now there's like spots in my ribs. There's spots like all over my spine again. There was something in my iliac bone, but for whatever reason, she's like, I don't know if these are all cancer. So let's just keep you on this for longer. So I'm still on it. It's like a sugar pill for me, but I'm still taking it. So that's how that's going.
Wow. I'm sort of taking it in because there's similarities to my experience too. And sort of feeling quite angry because I found my lump. And it was, it was just this hard but very smooth feeling lump in my breast because I was starting a new job the next day, so I didn't really think about it. And then because it was still there a couple of days later, I thought I'd better go and see a doctor. And so I went to what they would call like an after-hours clinic, and I was told, because I don't have children, oh, don't worry, you're too young for it to be anything bad. It's just be non-lactating mastitis. Don't worry. Maybe get a ultrasound if you want, but because that lump might be an abscess or something. But I just had this sense, 2 weeks later, because the antibiotics hadn't worked and my breast was just getting bigger and uncomfortable. And it was the same. It was breast cancer. And I just wish that even at medical school, they would teach people that actually, statistically, yes, people usually get breast cancer or other cancers older, but actually, younger women or younger people can get breast cancer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it would be super nice if the medical community could just catch up with that fact. And the other thing I was going to mention, so when I had my HER2 testing done, I'm HER2 2+. So basically when they do the staining, so they do the staining of the cell, and if it stains like super brightly and all over the place, you're 3+ and you're positive. But there's 3 other levels. You could have no stainage, you'd be 0, a little bit of stainage, 1, and then they put you in the HER2 negative category. If you have a bunch of staining but not enough to be considered immediately HER2 positive, you're HER2 2+. And then they do additional testing and decide if you're if you're positive or negative. So I actually have HER2 2+ breast cancer. And when they did the additional testing, I got a number that was pretty close to what would be considered HER2 positive. But because I'm negative, I don't get the Herceptin. It's apparently one of the worst categories to be in, is like HER2 2+, because you're HER2 low. You don't have enough of it to benefit from Herceptin, they say. But you're still going to have a more aggressive cancer than someone who's a 0 or a 1. So I'm looking more into that now because the traditional treatment is not working. I've been doing a fundraiser. The fundraiser is done for now. I raised $10,000 to go see like a doctor in the United States who specializes in HER2, low breast cancers. Like that's what he treats. Mm-hmm. And he's looking into like new treatments for it. And there's a clinical trial going on here in Calgary where I live for a drug called Enhertu. Mm. I'm not sure if you've heard of it. It's a newer drug that's related to Herceptin. It's basically Herceptin with like something else attached to it. And it goes into the HER2 cells. But if there's like cells nearby that don't have enough HER2, it still attacks those cells as well. So we're doing a trial here, but I can't get into it because I only have bone mets. So until I have soft tissue or visceral mets, I'm not allowed to go into the trial for the drug. Lots of screwed up things in the metastatic world. Yeah,
we were talking before about the similarities I think New Zealand and Canada has in terms of, you know, there is the public system. Mm-hmm. Talk to me a little bit about the system in Alberta. How has it worked for you and how do you have to navigate that as a cancer patient?
So the system in the whole of Canada is mostly public. Some provinces have like a little bit of private for some certain particular things, like certain operation stuff. But Alberta is like 100% public. It's an 100% public system. So thankfully, when I came in with my breast cancer diagnosis, they do get you in if you're like very, very high risk to oncologists pretty quickly. But there still was like a 2 or 3 week wait to see an oncologist, which is like freaky. Then once you get in to see your oncologist, you are allowed 5 minutes to speak to your oncologist. They give you a 5-minute appointment. The thing is that no one's able to do it in 5 minutes. So all that ends up happening is you end up waiting hours beyond your appointment time. So that's been difficult. Obviously, like the very straightforward cancer treatment we have here, and it's pretty okay. You go through your radiation, you go through your chemotherapy, all of that stuff's covered here. So if you have a straightforward case of cancer, our system works really well for you. When, however, you metastasize, metastatic cancer has traditionally, like metastatic breast cancer has traditionally not been a very good diagnosis. It is still not a very good diagnosis. Currently, the 5-year survival rate is 27%. But they always reassure you and they're saying, well, there's new drugs coming on the market. There's all this stuff going on, but it is still like a very, very bad diagnosis. You will have your outliers who you'll meet in like your cancer groups, people who have been living with metastatic cancer for 23 years. And that's great. But keep in mind that they are outliers. They're not your average case. I have proven to be an outlier on the wrong side of the curve. So basically, the first treatment I went on, the average person lasts on that treatment for 2 years. That treatment did not work at all for me. Like I've seen people live like 7, 8, 9, 10 years and just be on this treatment, which is pretty mild, although it's made all my hair fall out in the back. But it hasn't worked for me for some reason. Now I'm kind of like on the edge of science. I'm looking for that thing that's like going to help me when like the normal treatments haven't helped me. So my options now in Canada, now that I've gone through this treatment, is to go on to chemotherapy again. They have an oral chemotherapy, which is a little bit milder, that I can take first. My doctor says the longest she's seen anyone have progression-free survival for on that drug is 15 months. I'm 36, so that's not looking great for me. Then after that, I would have to go back on IV chemo, which is my nightmare because I would have to be going to the hospital like every week to get the treatments. And I actually hate it there. So in other places like the United States, I see all the variety of different treatments that women go on there. And there's not that many. It's not that great. But there are other treatments that they have here that we don't have. So for example, Piqray is a new drug and it actually has been approved now by Health Canada. So in the States, they would do genomic testing to your tumor and they would figure out if you had markers for like Piqray or PD-L1. These are all mutations that you can get in your cells. So as the cancer cells are dividing, because they're dividing so fast and they're so screwed up, they're mutating like all the time. And there's some common mutations because there's some common genes that are unstable, basically. And they'll look for those common mutations and some of them they can target with drugs. But we don't have the drugs here in Canada. So once you get out of that like standard area, that easy to treat, that straightforward place, and you're kind of more on the leading edge of science, I find that that public system starts to fail you. because they just take so long to review the drugs and get them into the system. And then there's so much bureaucracy around them, and they put so many rules on them because they really don't want to pay for them. And they'll say things like, a friend recently got told that she had like 5 types of chemotherapy she could try, and some of them were in pill form, which we prefer, obviously, because we don't want to be reminded like constantly that we're cancer patients. And we go to the hospital and we're seeing these cancer patients in a very bad state because they're at the end of the treatment. We don't want to be reminded of that all the time. So she finds out that she might be able to go on this pill form of chemo. Well, Canadian province will not cover it. She's in Ontario. Ontario said, no, we're not covering it. She goes to a private insurance. They say, sorry, we're not going to cover it because we don't think it will extend your life. And so now her choices are to go to the States or just pay $10,000 out of pocket for the drug. So she can like appeal to the company that sells the drug and say, please give me this, I need it. And they might say yes. She can raise money to pay for it, or she can pay $10,000 a month out of pocket.
Yeah. And I'm really, really struck by the similarities of patients here who are living with incurable cancer, because one of the issues that a lot of the, you know, the cancer advocacy groups and I think some of the oncologists have with Pharmac is that they take such a long time to approve drugs, you know, after trial and those sorts of things. Mm-hmm. And it's that similar thing of, you know, a lot of these drugs are life extending. You know, they're not going to cure a person of cancer. And I think until you have been in the situation where it's your life that is on the line and broken down to percentages, you don't realize that you will do anything to get that.
And some of the drugs, you know, there's so much hype around them, and then you'll read the paper and it's like, on average, this drug extended people's lives 5.2 months. And you're like, okay, I'm not fighting for that. Like, it's not enough time for me. For me, it would have to be years for me to be fighting for the drug. So I'm going to talk to them and see what they can do. And I'm doing a genomics test as well. Of course, that you also have to pay for out of pocket, because like, heaven forbid that we would allow you to like do that kind of thing, right? It's not life extending. The thing also is that if something is really life extending for a few patients, what there's always going to be is those outliers, those superior performers for every drug. And you never know if you're going to be that superior performer for a particular drug. But if not enough people are superior performers, then even though you might have been, they're not going to cover the drug, because they're going to say on average it doesn't extend life.
It's really messed up, isn't it? Because it's, you know, there are so many factors to it, and it's I imagine when it's, you know, and I've been in that position at the beginning of being diagnosed with, you know, when they said it was we're doing a curative, you know, regime, and they were being offered pertuzumab and being said and being told that, it might extend things or might give you maybe 1 to 2% more, and in your head you're thinking, do I take that? Is that? It's very hard to take that out of the decision making, because it seems like, you know, that still is an individual who deserves to be given the best treatment, but that's not always the way that it works, and it certainly isn't here. I mean, I remember reading that New Zealand is one of the worst places to be if your cancer comes back.
I read that Canada is like number 17 on the list right now.
Yeah.
I don't know how long the list is. 17 didn't sound great to me. It didn't sound amazing. But yeah, it's not as perfect. I mean, a lot of people in the States, they think it's so idyllic here, because if you're going through a standard treatment, like if you're having a baby or if you get an infection or if you're going through standard chemo treatment, it's great. But when you get outside of that, it's not super anymore.
No, not at all. And I think, you know, what has struck me, because, you know, of following you on Twitter, and, you know, you have a child, you have a young girl that you are, that you're raising, but also having the knowledge that, you know, you don't get to see her grow up.
Yeah, it sucks. That's a bad part. So I don't know if you saw my recent bucket list. I added it today. And so one of the things, I'd really like to have her picture like age progressed, so I could see what she was going to look like. Because at least that would kind of give me an idea of what she was going to be like when she grew up, at least like looks wise. I'll just make the rest of it up. Yeah, it's really tough. It's not been ideal for sure. She was 7 months old with the primary treatment, and I just like fell into like a deep depression. So I'm actually like less depressed now than I was with the primary treatment. It's weird.
Because I have spoken to other people who have advanced cancer, and, you know, there's that double whammy. So there's that first diagnosis, and that is, you know, like a bomb goes off.
Yeah.
You know, it's a huge thing. But to have to go through that again, is it the same or is it a different feeling?
I think it kind of depends on if you're like a pessimist or a optimist. So like say you're an optimist and you're going through treatment, you're always going to think you're going to be in that 70% who like gets through the treatment and they're fine forever. I'm a pessimist. So I was like, no, it's coming back. So I was dealing with the emotions of it being a terminal diagnosis, like right from the start. So I actually had to spend some time in the psych ward because that's how depressed I got. I spent a month there. I loved it. It was so much fun. It was great. There was like so many cool people and no one had their cell phones. So everyone had to talk to you. And it just like, you had a lot of time to read. You watched movies together. You played games. It was great. It was like summer camp for me. Other people did not like it, but I loved it. But then when it came back, I just was like, oh yeah, I already knew it was going to come back. But if you were an optimist, there's been some people who are like big optimists. They wouldn't be trying to get scans all the time like I was either. So they probably would be a few years in to the metastatic part before they notice. Because like right now I have about 10 mets and I actually can't even really feel them. So you'd have to be like pretty meddy before you were like, oh my God, something's going on. So they would probably have waited a year or two more. And then they go and bang, they get this surprise. And some of them, it would have been even longer because it might take longer to come back. I think that is like more depressing for those people because they're not expecting it to come back and then it does. And they're having to then process the feelings of it being terminal, whereas I had already processed those feelings. So I had already gone from like thinking that I had this great life and it was going to be long and I was going to be with my daughter for a long time and I was going to have another baby to being like, my life is destroyed. And then like having to sort of like come back from that a bit. So for me, I've not really fallen back into the same hole because it's going from a healthy person to a sick person versus going from a sick person to a sick, sicker person. The healthy to sick was the hardest transition for me.
I don't know whether it was same for you where I didn't, before I got the diagnosis, I mean, I felt a little bit run down, but I didn't feel sick.
I actually like, so I have rheumatoid arthritis as well because I collect like old lady diseases and I was gifted that on my 23rd birthday. So that disease, it's, I had what my doctor described as one of the most severe cases of inflammatory, like autoimmune arthritis he'd ever seen. Like I couldn't dress myself. I couldn't walk. This lasted for a year because the Canadian health system failed me because they wouldn't get me in to see a rheumatologist for a year after I told them I couldn't walk or dress myself. So this was like a terrible time. I had to like quit everything. I quit school, blah, blah, blah. And then once you get in to see the rheumatologist, you have to go through these like worse drugs before you can get the better drugs. So the whole process takes you like 2 years of your life. So I was in pain from that. And then they put me on some good drugs and I was doing a lot better. But then the good drugs would like slowly stop working. So it would like come back. And they were kind of stopping working when I got the diagnosis. And then they put me on the chemo drugs and they just knock out your immune system. So I was like feeling the best I had felt in a long time. So I actually loved the chemo. And strangely, like since having the treatment and going on the CDK4/6 inhibitor, I've actually like basically been cured of rheumatoid arthritis. Like it's gone. I don't know why, but I have terminal cancer now. So that was my trade-in.
Jesus. It's hard when you have something that you have no control over. You want to find those answers. You want to, you know, investigate and figure it out because it just makes no sense of, you know, why, you know, if I look at us, I was 37 when it happened, two young people.
Yeah, living pretty average lives. And that's why I hate when people are like, because this comes up all the time, where people will tell me, one person told me that I need to let go of my anger from my childhood and then my cancer would go away. I had a person tell me if I just like ate white rice and drank water for a few months, the cancer would go away. And the most recent one, which is pretty bad, this woman told me to stop eating for 43 days. She just said, you just stop eating for 43 days and your cancer will go away. I said, I feel like if I die from starvation, like maybe we can say I died from something else, but I don't know if that is curing cancer. She's like, just drink water. You'll be fine.
No.
No. That's called starvation. Like, that's going to be really hard on my body. Like, it's not a good answer. there's a lot of people out there that want to think that there's this magic cure. And I think it's like a security blanket for them. They're like, the doctors won't let them have the cure. It's like, that's not a thing. That's not happening.
And I actually interviewed a scientist from the UK who wrote a book called Rebel Cell about cancer and its origins and things. That was really interesting because she spoke about things like the fact that cancer has been around. Because it's if you have cells, you can get cancer because it's, you know, a mutation of your cells. And part of her job prior to, you know, to becoming an author was researching and looking into some of these, you know, I think they're snake oil peddlers. And she, she said that it's very difficult to find any evidence that any of these things actually work. And I think that it just, it preys on our vulnerabilities.
Yeah, and I'm pretty scientific, but even I have been like, okay, I'm going to go try some of them. And I ended up like spending, you know, $2,000 of my money and still having like more mats on my next test. And then one of them, though, there's this one treatment that I kind of thought, well, maybe this is a thing. There's this doctor in the United States called Dr. Badat, and she's looking into, so what she found was, like, particularly with triple negative cancer, a little bit with estrogen positive, not really with HER2, that if she deprived the cells of copper, and she's like a bona fide scientist, she's not a quack. She's like a real university scientist. She's running like a proper experiment. She was depriving the cells of copper by giving them this thing. It's called TM. I can't remember what the whole name is. It's very long. And some of the patients did like extremely well on this. But because it's a treatment for another disease called, I think it's called Wilson's disease, which is when you have too much copper in your blood. That company that owns the drug rights, like, they don't want to study it in cancer. And so she's going to have to save up the money herself or like for her group or whatever to do the actual clinical trial on it. I tried it. It hasn't worked for me, but I did. Yeah. I am still doing it. It gives you sulfur burps, but it might. That one's worth looking into, I think. Dr. Badat. Talk to me a little bit about it. But most things, I look it up. So somebody told me to try like alkaline water. And I was like, that's very interesting. Because there's a lot of people who are like, acids and bases. You know, your blood's too acidic. It's too basic now. It's like, no. There's buffers in your blood. It's 7.4. That's the pH. It's a little bit basic. It doesn't matter what you eat. It's always going to come back to that point. That's your, like, equilibrium in your body, your homeostasis. But this girl's like, you got to try alkaline water. So I spent, like, an hour looking it up. No, it's stupid. It's not a real thing. So most of them. Just do a little research into it.
Yeah, you set up an email address for your daughter.
Yes.
And I thought that was quite amazing. And tell me a little bit about that and what you're collecting.
I'm just trying to, like, and I've been doing quite a bit of research on it, actually, too. Just, like, if you have a parent that dies, because we don't have, well, I guess my mom's dad died, and that was really hard on her. But I haven't met a lot of people who've had a parent die when they're at a very young age. So she's not going to remember much about me if I die in the next couple of years. And all she's going to have are like pictures. So I started sort of researching like what else would you want to have from your parents if they died early or people who had that experience, what did you want from them? And one of the things people had suggested was to like write an email, set up an email and like write a little like, you know, tips and hints and just different emails and stuff. So I have started doing that, but I've got a whole bunch of other things for her too. So I've been using this app that like makes memory books. They're very expensive. They're like $100 a book. So my husband, when I first started doing it when she was born, he's like, just for this year. And we're into like year 2.5 now. And I'm like, no, because of the change in our circumstance, like, I'm just going to keep doing it. And then the other thing is this app, it's called Record Me Now, I think. I don't know if you've heard of it. No. And it's basically this person researched like people whose parents had died. They researched the people when they were adults and they asked them like, what are some questions that you would ask your parent if you could talk to them today? And they took all those questions and they compiled them and you basically like open the app and you record the answer to one of the questions together or one of the questions and then you do as many as you want and it makes a video for your kid. So I'm doing that as well, just trying to like leave her those memories that she's not going to have and my husband won't know the answers because I like don't tell him about my like boyfriends from when I was in junior high or like, you know, certain things. I just don't tell him. So for her to have those memories. Yeah. I also have journals from when I was young and I didn't want my husband to read them because they're literally like, they're so embarrassing. So I gave them to my sister, even though I didn't really want her to read them either. But I was like, hey, you can't look at them, but just like save these for my daughter. And then she read them. So she read them, and I had this feature that I would do weekly. It was called All Kim. And it was, I'd write like a little thing about something stupid that she'd done. So she'd go through the journals and she looked for all of those. And then she's been bugging me about it ever since. But that was one of the things I left her to. But with the email, I said, like, if other people who lost their parents wanted to like send my daughter some advice, of course, I'll be like curating it all. But they could as well. But yeah, just like advice and stuff like that, because my husband's going to just be not very good, like talking to her about boys. And that was something I was really disappointed about. Like, I've developed all of this life experience and now I'm like not going to be able to pass it on to my little prototype. So all of the like hard experiences, like she probably wouldn't have listened to me anyway, but like all of these difficult experiences that I've had, I feel like, well, now were they just for nothing? I've had some pretty bad boyfriends and I really wanted to like tell her, like, don't date guys off the internet. They're creepy.
How has your family responded to your terminal diagnosis?
It's been really difficult. My mother had breast cancer. She had it in 2001, maybe. And hers was triple negative. And it was found on a scan because at that time they were scanning women in their 40s in Canada. If she had it today, she would have died because we're no longer scanning women in their 40s. She had no idea it was there. She went to the doctor. They did a scan. It was actually almost 2 centimeters and she had no idea it was there. They did all the treatment. She is fine. She's doing well. So when this first happened, she told me, you're going to get sick, because it was early stage at the time. She's like, you're going to get sick, but like no one dies of breast cancer. Like this is literally someone who has had breast cancer and their doctor has not instilled in them that people die of breast cancer. So she knows now, our whole family knows. But the thing is, like, because of all this pink washing and the downplaying of breast cancer and the focus on survivors, not that survivors aren't important because we're really happy that some people are surviving it. But if we know that 1 in 3 are dying from it, and we know that 1 in 30 women in Canada are still dying from breast cancer. Like, that's a pretty big number. You're sitting in a room of 30 people, a classroom, one of you is going to die of breast cancer. Anyway, we had no idea that it was like this serious and this bad and that this many people were still dying in it. We thought that we had like a handle on breast cancer. So we've learned a lot. My dad is having a hard time with it because we are best friends. So it's very hard for him. We had a couple of really big fights. And it's just been like really stressful because the whole COVID thing going on as well. My parents live out of town and so they haven't been able to come see me a lot. So we've had some arguments about that. It's been really difficult. My sister's having a hard time as well. My husband, he's had like a couple of breakdowns. He hates talking about it. And I actually talk about it a lot because this is like my whole life now because I no longer have my career or future. Yep. So we talk about it quite a bit. That really bugs him. My daughter is okay now, but I found that when I first got the early diagnosis, and this might just be in my imagination, she was like a really smiley baby. And then like she wasn't smiling as much in pictures and stuff. I feel like she was like stressed out. She was only 7 months old, but I feel like she like felt that there'd like been some change. And now like I don't think she likes it when I'm like in bed a lot. But we do like watch Grinch and stuff like that. Her favorite show right now is The Grinch. She calls him The Pinch. So we try not to like let the stress get to her. Like if we know that something really stressful is going to happen, like my doctor telling me that I like now had 4 additional mets on my spine, we send her up to her grandmother's house so that she'll be like protected from it. So
yeah, give yourself
won't have as much impact. But it's something I worry about a lot is like the impact on her. Because I read this story about this mom who was really sick and how her daughter liked to go to her friend's house because she hated to be like in that house where like this terminal illness was going on. And that like really concerns me because obviously if things get worse when she's older, like I don't want her to hate being at home.
Yeah, I mean, it's challenging. I can only imagine these are things that you never ever thought you'd be.
Yeah.
Planning for or dealing with.
Reading a lot of books, like trying to review books, because you can get books sent to you from like breast cancer organizations. They'll like procure a bunch of books that might be good for your kid. But all of us in like the metastatic group, we're like, well, these books aren't relevant to us. Like they're like about a woman losing her hair and then getting better. But like if I'm reading this to my child, like I'm kind of lying to them because I'm not going to lose my hair and I'm not probably not going to get better. So I started like procuring books from Amazon that I thought might be like a good match for, you know, families with terminal cancer. And I've been kind of reviewing them online and stuff as well. And then I've been reading them to her, some of them. Like, obviously, she's just, like, not old enough yet for a lot of that, like, to talk about, like, it being a terminal diagnosis. So I read her this book called, like, Lifespans, and it was about how all animals die. That's just the way it is, it says in the book. So just to get used to that idea that people die and animals die, I don't think she really gets it yet, but...
Yeah, it's very hard to. I think it's a hard concept to get your head around as an adult, let alone as a,
you know, a 2-year-old. I've never really thought about it before. People think they thought about death. They think they have a good idea of it. But they've thought of it as like an abstract concept that's like going to happen in like the future. It totally changes your perspective if that's like going to happen soon and you're in your 30s. People will be like, everyone's dying. And I'm like, that's not the same. Like, it's not the same at all. You're not imminently dying. You don't know what you're going to die of. You don't have like a good idea of what that's going to look like.
And I think I want to touch on something you said before, because I've really noticed it as well in New Zealand, the pink washing. Mm-hmm. And I understand in some ways, you know, for the breast cancer charities that if they want to raise money and things, that it's, you know, you kind of need to have hopeful, you know, imagery and all that sort
of
thing.
People want to feel like they're helping. They want to feel like they're fixing something with their money.
Yeah. And I very rarely use the word that I'm a cancer survivor or a cancer warrior. I just don't like
the term warrior. No, I don't use that.
No. You know, I'm someone who has had cancer. I had a cancer experience because I feel like people who have advanced cancer get ignored. You know, because it's not the nice story that we want to tell. But the fact is that breast cancer is not a nice, it's not a nice fluffy pink disease. Mm-hmm. It is a brutal disease that can kill us. But I guess that's not the story.
It's a nefarious disease. Yeah, I made my own website, actually. I can send you the link after. And I haven't registered as a charity yet because I am really bad at printing off forms. But I'm hoping to register as a charity so we can, like, extend our fundraising efforts. So far, we've fundraised, like, I think $3,300. So it's not going great. But basically, I made the website and then I showed it to like a marketing person and I said, what should I add to this? And she's like, smiling women. And I was like, no, that's not going to work. Like, we're not going to put like women like beaming about their stage 4 diagnosis on it. Like, you know what? We'll put that on there when there's a cure. We'll change the whole view of the website when it's cured and then we'll be smiling.
Yeah. And I interviewed a woman last year who has advanced breast cancer now, and you know, I was really conscious that I didn't want to sort of set it up as, oh, she's so inspirational and so positive and things. Because I sort of think we don't owe that to anyone. Like, none of us have to be this, like, smiling, inspirational cancer patient because it's actually, cancer is shit.
Yeah, I'm actually trying to be, the opposite of inspirational on Twitter. I don't know if you've noticed.
I really like it.
Like, it's like once in a while I'll say something inspirational, but most of the time it's, like, not very inspirational because I want people to know, like, it's really shitty. Like, you know what, if somebody was like, could you cut off both your legs and one arm and we'll cure your cancer, I would say yeah. I mean, I've never lived without legs and an arm, so I don't want that to sound offensive to people without legs or an arm, but I feel like right now, having not experienced that yes, I would give up both legs and one arm and actually my whole house, all of that, and my car, maybe my pets, but probably not, but some things, if I could just like have my cancer taken away, just like anything.
Yeah, and I feel, I guess, you know, the stakes are really high for you. Mm-hmm. You have a family.
Yeah.
And those are, you know, when we get married or we have children, we sort of have this idea of, you know, what the path will be, and trying to accept that, you know, we've gone off course.
Well, I think of it like a snow globe. So, like, and I felt like that ever since I got diagnosed. That like before I like lived in the real world and I was like a part of it and I like went to work and I contributed to the world and I had like this thing that I was doing and what I was working towards, and it was like a ladder to like my future, right? But now I like live in a snow globe. I can still see everything that's going on outside and I can like kind of interact with them, but it's like muffled. Like, I'm not really a part of it. Like, my experience is not entirely like their experience now. It's like I'm closed off from everything else that's happening. I can go hang out with them, but people don't even notice like how often they drop into conversation like comments about the future. And if that's been taken from you, like, you start to like really hear it and it really bothers you. So when I first was diagnosed, I had my hair shaved off by my friend who is a hairdresser. And she was talking about, like, with my mom, because my mom was asking her, like, what do you want to do in the next few years? How she wanted to go do her master's degree and she wanted to do this and that. And that has been taken from me. Like, I don't have it anymore. I don't have that future. Like, maybe I do. Maybe I will live 10 or 15 years, but probably not. And that's a big thing to lose. Even if it's just, like, perceived, even if we could lose it at any moment, going from, like, oh, I'm probably going to have that, like, there's, like, a 99.9% chance that I'm going to live to 50, to, like, okay, there's, like, an 11% chance. It's a big loss.
It's huge. Mm-hmm. It's massive. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we can downplay that until you've walked into your shoes, you don't know.
Think it would feel like people think, you know, if I had a cancer diagnosis, I'd be this super inspirational person. I would keep doing everything. I'd go to grad school, even though, like, I had a bad diagnosis, because, like, I would be so inspirational and I would be, like, optimist. And it's like, no, you wouldn't. Like, you don't even know what you'd be doing. You don't know what you'd be feeling. You have no idea. And that goes for any traumatic experience, that once you've had a few traumatic experiences, you realize that, like, people saying that they would do certain things, like, it doesn't make you sound expiring. It makes you sound dumb. It makes you sound, like, disconnected and tone deaf.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, people don't know what it's like, especially, like, a mastectomy. Like, when people say stuff like, it's a free boob job because you get new boobs. It's like, but you're losing your nipples and your skin, so they don't really look like boobs, like, the same as they did before.
Yeah, well, I mean, like me, I haven't had a reconstruction.
Yeah, I didn't have a reconstruction. I only got one off in the end. I, like, chickened out on the day. I was like, no, I want to keep this one, like, just in case. And so now I have, like, a really lopsided chest.
Yeah.
And I didn't have a reconstruction, and, like, now they won't give it to me. So this is what I look like now.
Yeah.
And I have, like, fantasy reel that I play in my head where I, like, get cured and I get, like, a new boob put on and everything goes back to normal and I, like, adopt a baby from a foreign country. I cure cancer. I'm celebrated all over the world.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of The C Word. If you want to send a message to the email Libby has set up for her daughter, I'll put all of that information in the show notes for today. You can also follow Libby on Twitter to keep up with how she's going, and I'll also include a link to her bucket list. The C Word Kiwis Talk About Cancer is every Sunday at 11:55 a.m. on Auckland's 104.6 Planet FM and streams anytime at planetaudio.org.nz/thecword. Join me next week when I catch up with a young Australian woman who is encouraging people who have had breast cancer to claim their voice. See you next time. La 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 la. Yeah. What's the deal? Ain't nothing, Paul. We just chilling, we having all that. Trying to get our heads right, get this money right, and all that. You know what I'm saying? You know how it goes. It's another day in the hood. Yo. 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 One night, New York City. Heard it going down. Friday night, midnight, Atlantic City. Slash machines, ding, 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 ding. When they ring off, lock the doors. That's when those kids beat those. Cigars, paisley robes. Four bitches guarded me safely as we walked to the window. The cashier was scared, she asked for my info. The manager arrived with two guys, that's an insult. That's the cold, Mr. Coles. We talking about $5 million here. This ain't Play-Doh, though. And your horoscope red, you gon' slay those. We got scribbles, Anthony Acid, rocking the show. Special guest star, Mark Bronson. First 500 bitches went crazy when he let they aunt in. All he did was plug me in. I got the charging, got they bras and ran through they whole department. By the ladies who looking for some.
dubs, rolling a bud. The theater unit, we controlling the club. Mommy shaking the yak, they throwing it up like a BT commercial. I'm grabbing the mug. Jump the pump when I bang big bullets. I buck up a chump. I love to get a bitch that's stuck up the hump. Act dog and my foot get stuck up your rump. Like boom, yeah, I heard. I'm busting, that's my word. So if you get out of line and your is mine, and I'ma run up in your house, put it in your mouth. I might be new to the game, what? But it's a damn shame what a brother about to do to the game. I got Mark Rum backing me up. I'm already on a song with Nate Dogg. That's why you wanna hate dog? Here's a warning. When Mark bring the horns in, say the wrong thing and you won't see the morning. You won't get dealt with, man. Yo, Nate, man, let's ride on this. Come on.
Until my blood begins to boil. Crazy how It's everything I ever really wanted. Completely yours, completely loyal. Everything you seem to see to get high and closing in on that explosion. Everything you gon' make me do, hitting it once, then twice, and you then three times, then four or more. Let you know I'm ready for the heat.
You know that I'm proud and I can't get the words out. Ooh.